Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Roerink. A little later, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Bridget McCormick, will be joining us. But first, we've got a very special podcast with Steve Mitchell from Mitchell Research and Communications. He did some polling for MERS and GCSI and the insurance industry. And John, why don't you tell our listeners exactly what we did and why?
Every year, probably for the last four or five cycles now, I think we've worked with Governmental Consultant Services Incorporated to provide their clients a briefing, and we've done polling on key legislative races that were of note that particular cycle. This year, we're lucky enough to be joined by the Life Insurance Association of Michigan as well as the Insurance Alliance of Michigan. So we've got four partners doing it this time. So we're really excited. We spent some time. I know you were part of the meetings, Kyle. Steve was part of the meetings, sort of figuring out which districts to poll in. And sure enough, by the time we got the polls ready and in the water, there were probably a couple more we wished we would have been able to do. But that's politics. So I'm really excited about talking to Steve about what we found. I think it's fascinating so far from what I've seen. So I'll turn it over to the pollster.
Thank you very much, John. I appreciate that. Just a little perspective. Right now, nationally, according to the Real Clear Politics averages, Joe Biden is up by 6.5 points over Donald Trump, 49% to 43%. Here in Michigan, the lead is about the same. It's about 48% to 43%. The perspective I'm about to add is that today, Biden leads, as I say, by 6.5%. Go back 4 years at the exact same time, and the Real Clear Politics averages showed that Hillary Clinton led Donald Trump by 6.3%. There's a long way to go between here and Election Day, and so just because at this point Trump is behind, nothing is guaranteed in politics, and certainly in a topsy-turvy world, as we saw over the weekend with the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and the likely appointment of a conservative justice to the Supreme Court by Trump. With that in mind, and with those atmospherics in mind, let's take a look at some of the races that we did. But before I do, I want to say that in all of the races, we also checked how Trump was doing, the Gary Peters versus John James race was going, and if there was a competitive congressional race, we also tested that congressional race. Then we tested the candidates for state representative. So with that in mind, let's go ahead to the first district that we did, which is House District 19. It's really the entire city of Livonia. It's a seat that has been traditionally a Republican seat. It was picked up in the 2018 cycle with the strong showing of Gretchen Whitmer by a Democrat named Lori Bohutsky. And she's running this time against Marsha Pashnik. Both names start with P, and both names are somewhat hard to pronounce. But in the 19th district, Biden is leading 49 to 44, Biden doing about what he's doing statewide. However, the race for the U.S. Senate in that area is very close. In fact, Gary Peters, the incumbent U.S. Senator who's now running for a second term, trails the Republican challenger, John James. In the congressional seat, we also have a very close race there. Erica Shockey is challenging incumbent Congresswoman Haley Stevens, who won the congressional seat back 2 years ago when David Trott retired, a Republican. And Stevens leads by only 1.47 to 46. Equally close is that state rep race where Lori Bohutsky, the incumbent Democrat, is up by only 2%, 47 to 45% against Marsha Pashnik. Any comments on that seat before we move forward to the next one, guys?
A couple of things. Steve, what's the margin of error of the polling that we did, just so our listeners understand what we're talking about?
All of these polls were roughly N equals 300. We used a combination of interactive voice response, which is IVR, automated polling for those over the age of 45. And then we had a set of cell phone calls that we went to 18 to 29-year-olds and to 30 to 44-year-olds. So the margin error on that is about plus or minus 5%, 5.6%. So a wide margin of error, but generally we feel our polling has been very accurate. We are within the margin of error in the very tough Democratic U.S. primary presidential primary that was held on March 6th here in Michigan. Matter of fact, out of, I think, 10 polls, we were the second most accurate and the most accurate Michigan pollster. So we feel pretty confident in this technique of polling.
Yeah, and I wanted to touch on here your thoughts on this presidential race in Livonia. Biden up 5 points, so outside of the margin of error. But John James actually winning in Livonia. And then the it looks like in the congressional race, it's a toss-up. And in the state house race, you know, Pahutsky's up too, but that's not outside the margin of error. So that's almost a toss-up. So what do you make of this? What do you make of the political dynamic in Livonia?
Well, Livonia is a traditionally Republican community. It has always, for the most part, had Republican representatives in the state legislature. And it also has had, up until the last election, a Republican mayor, a guy named Jack Kirksey, actually retired at the age of 87 as mayor of Livonia. So it's a Republican community. Again, Pahutsky was able to win because of a huge voter turnout, a lot of women turning out back in 2018, and the Republican candidate didn't work as hard as he should, especially in a race that's a tough race in a tough year. So I think Pahutsky's in for a real battle. This one's going to go all the way down to the finish line, I think.
All right, well, let's continue to the next one.
All right, the next district we did is the 25th district, which is in Macomb County. We wanted to get a sense of what are the dynamics over in Macomb County. And again, Macomb County, which has been traditionally Republican, this part of the district, which is represented by a Democrat, Nate Shannon, Joe Biden's up 50.5 to 44%. So Biden up with a considerable lead in this district. At the same time, Gary Peters is ahead by only a 48 to 43% margin. So his margin is less than the margin that Donald Trump, that Joe Biden has in that district. In the House district, Nate Shannon, the incumbent Democrat, leads 48% to 41% over Paul Smith, no relation to the radio announcer at WJR Radio named Paul W. Smith.
Mm-hmm. Now, the reason I wanted this race in particular was because I wanted to see how far Trump's impact in Macomb County went. Obviously, we know that once you get north in that district, you start getting into, you know, Ray Township, or, you know, you start getting further up north, Trump is extremely popular. And I want to see how far south that went, with the 25th district being the northern part of Warren and then half of Sterling Heights. But based on these poll results, you know, Biden's doing pretty good. Does that have to do with Biden's appearance in Warren just a couple weeks ago, or what do you account this for?
Well, there's no doubt that candidate appearances are very important. They move the needle. That's why one of the reasons that Donald Trump won this state. There's no doubt in my mind, as an example, that had Trump not finished the campaign in Grand Rapids on the eve of the election, actually moving into Election Day itself, he would have lost Michigan. That final appearance in Grand Rapids cemented it for him. So that does have an impact. Again, Trump is still having trouble with the base. He's got the hardcore base, but this is a suburban area, and you've just got to do better in these suburban areas and in Macomb County than this if you expect to win Michigan.
Looking at your poll results, which of course is just a snapshot in time, it's like a 6.5 point swing for Trump. He carried this district by 52.4% of the vote.
And let me, again, go back to that statement I made. Nationally, he led, Hillary Clinton led him by 6.5 points. Right now, he trails by 6.3%. I think it's important to note that this polling was done before the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg over the weekend, which will have a huge impact on this race. Who is going to impact the most? I don't know. I suspect it's going to benefit Trump. I think that that's going to bring out some conservative evangelical voters who might not otherwise have voted. I think the anti-vote is so angry at this point that they're going to go to the polls. If they had to walk over glass and broken glass and bare feet, they would get to the polls. So I think that actually it inures to the benefit of Trump.
What days were you in the water with these polls?
These polls were done. They were done last week. They were done between the 14th and the 18th.
And then the other reason why I wanted to do the 25th is I wanted to see how far Trump's influence went statewide as well. So you have a candidate in Paul Smith who has a lot of negatives on him. He's got a long history of saying some offensive things. And so I was curious to see if Trump's impact would, kind of carry Paul Smith, see if he had coattails at all. Clearly he doesn't. And it would probably explain why the Republicans are going north as far as spending money and going into the Brian Elder seat in the 96th district. We didn't pull the 96th district, but I think this kind of shows why the Republicans are going up there. Clearly, they don't have an advantage here and probably are not going to be successful on this one. And then, the demographics here probably are fairly similar to Southern Genesee County with Cheryl Kennedy. And if Nate Shannon's winning by such a good margin here, I got to imagine Cheryl Kennedy's kind of in the same boat. But maybe Northern Michigan, they'd have better results in Bay City.
What you see is a fundamental realignment in Michigan as well as in the whole country. Areas that were formerly very strongly Democratic have now become very strongly pro-Trump and therefore Republican. Think areas like Monroe, Macomb, even more Republican than it has been in the past, although it doesn't show in this particular seat. Moving over to Muskegon, much more Republican. Moving up the whole I-75 corridor into Flint, Saginaw, and Bay City, same thing, much more Republican than they ever were. The Upper Peninsula, which at one time almost every county in the UP went Democratic, in 2016, Donald Trump won every county in the Upper Peninsula except Marquette, where there's a major university, 7,600 students and 1,000 faculty members and employees, many of whom are liberal. So this fundamental realignment has taken place. Meanwhile, suburbs in Kent County, Oakland County, and other areas that were formerly very Republican have become Democratic in Oakland, Kent, Kalamazoo County. So a real realignment has taken place in Michigan politics.
And talking about that realignment, let's move on to the next district, the 39th State House District, which is Commerce Township and West Bloomfield. And you are seeing that realignment for the Democrats.
Absolutely. This is an area where Trump is down by 15 points. It trails 54% to 39%. Senator Gary Peters has a 11-point lead over John James, 51 to 40. In the congressional race, Haley Stevens, who is the incumbent Democratic congresswoman in her first term, leads Eric Ashaki 53 to 39. Remember, in that Livonia seat, this race was very, very close, within 1 point. And in the House seat, Ryan Berman, who really got a lucky break 2 years ago, he was running against another woman candidate, but during the campaign, it was discovered she had embezzled money, over $100,000 from the Oakland County treasurer. And so she was going to jail. And so Ryan Berman won that seat without much trouble. He's in for a real battle with Julia Pulver leading Berman by 4%, 47 to 43%. So there's another 2% going to a Libertarian candidate named Anthony Croft.
And then let's move over to the 45th district, which is also Oakland County. This is Rochester Hills. And again, good news for Democrats, but not as wide of a margin.
Yeah, this is good news. This is a Republican seat held by Mike Weber currently. In this seat, Trump down by 7% in what has always been a very Republican area. The former congressman, Senate Majority Leader Mike Bishop, is from this area. He lost in the last election to Alyssa Slotkin, who's now the current Republican, Democratic incumbent congresswoman. Trump leads 50 to 43, a 7-point lead. Peters lead much closer, 49% over John James at 45%, a 4% lead. In the congressional race, Slotkin has a huge lead in this area, again, that was represented by Mike Bishop up to 2 years ago, a year and a half ago. Slotkin's leading Paul Young, 54% to 38%. And then there's a third-party candidate named Joe Hartman who's got 2%. In the actual state rep race, Barb Annis, a very strong candidate with local roots, running against an equally strong candidate with a local roots, president of the Rochester City Council, Mark Tisdall. Tisdall, a very successful businesswoman, a businessman. And this is a 1-point race with Barb Annis leading 45% to 44%. So this is going to be another real nail biter all the way down to the end.
You know, what really struck me here, Steve, is how large the lead is for Alyssa Slotkin. I know she's an incumbent, but so is Gary Peters. And Gary Peters is only up 4%, whereas Alyssa Slotkin is up, 16 percentage points over Paul Young, and she's a freshman as well. She's overperforming Joe Biden by 4 points. Just give me your thoughts here on that. I mean, that's pretty marked.
You've got an area that is a very sophisticated one where voters will switch back and forth. That's a good news for the Republicans because Trump is not doing well. And this is part of that realignment that I was talking about. You've got areas like Rochester, Rochester Hills, suburban Oakland County that used to be very strongly Republican. And now because of President Trump and some people not liking his personality, you see that this is a very much, much more Democratic seat. There's also a huge spending advantage that Slotkin has in this race. So I think she's benefiting from the atmospherics as well as, everybody talked about 2018 being the pink wave. It was actually the green wave. Democrats outspent Republicans in key seats like Alyssa Slotkin defeating Mike Bishop and Haley Stevens winning the seat that was open in the 11th district because they had a 50% greater funding advantage over their Republican opponents.
So, John, what stood out to you in this 45th State House district?
The same thing that struck me in some of the earlier races is how much the position of Trump is different in these polls versus the outcome on Election Day 4 years ago. Not that that can't change, but the last three districts we've talked about, the Republicans have reason to be worried because Trump has lost a lot of ground.
All right. Well, let's move on to a little further west in the state in the 61st State House District, which is Portage, a little more suburban Kalamazoo County, and the seat that is currently held by Brant Eyden.
This, of all the seats that we looked at, I think I was a little more surprised by the results in this one because the state rep race was closer because, and we'll get into that in a second, because the Republicans have a very strong candidate here. In that 61st House District over in the Portage, Kalamazoo area, the president's losing again by 16 points, 54% to 38%, that fundamental realignment we talked about. Gary Peters also has a huge lead over John James in this seat, 52% to 39%. Even in the congressional race in an area that is represented currently by Fred Upton. Fred's the dean of the Michigan delegation, having been first elected to the House back in 1984, has always been a moderate Republican, has moved a little more to the right over the past few years because of potential Republican challenges and won a narrow victory. Fred's back up this time, but in this area, he's actually trailing by 19 points to John Hoadley, 54% to 35%. There are two other candidates, a Republican and Green Party candidate, both of whom are getting 4% in this race. So even Fred's losing in this area. In the House race, however, Christine Morris, the Democrat, leads Bronwyn Haltom, the Republican, 45% to 41%. And I was surprised this one was as close as it was because this is a very tough seat. But everything I've heard and I've not met her is that Bronwyn Haltom is a very, very strong candidate, raised an enormous amount of money and is running a really good campaign and doing it upstream, as it were, against some real problems with voters who are supporting the Democrats in both the presidential race, the U.S. Senate race, and then also, thirdly, in the congressional race.
Well, the thing about Bronwyn Holton is she not only raised a lot of money, she brought a lot of money into the race, but she spent it early too, Steve. I was getting internet ads for Bronwyn Holton about a year ago at about this time, it feels like, and I don't have the exact date, but she's been spending and getting her name out for a long time. So as far as all of the Republican candidates running an open seat so far, she has done the best as far as improving her name ID and expanding her reach. So to only be 4 points down in a race where Fred Upton's down 19 in the district, pretty high props to her for keeping it close.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a tribute to the campaign that she's been running from day one. Whether she can hang on, I don't know. You're going to see a lot of money spent in this race by both sides. It's a very important seat for both the Democrats and the Republicans as they battle for control of the Michigan House.
What's fascinating is how much has already been raised. I mean, Holton has raised $338,000 already for this. Some of that was her own money, but this is already $500,000 race.
Yeah, it's a lot of dough to be spending, but politics is there's a lot at stake. The majority is at stake. Republicans control the Michigan House 58-52 right now. So if they lose three seats, it's a tie. They lose four, they're out of control.
So next door in the 62nd District, this is the Battle Creek seat. And this is one that we wanted to do because we wanted to get a flavor of what was going on in West Michigan without getting into necessarily Kent County, where the seats might not be as competitive. The 62nd is a district that John Bison represented in the state house until he was term limited out. And now Jim Hodsma is the candidate for the Democrats. He was successful in 2018. But this is a race that we thought would be interesting to take a look at also because it includes the 3rd Congressional District, where the Democrats feel like they have an opportunity with their candidate, Hillary Scolton. So, Steve, tell our listeners what you found here.
Again, Trump doing very poorly. The type of seat that you would expect he would. Battle Creek has always been a very ticket-splitting area. They like more moderate Republicans. Joe Schwartz represented this area in the state house, the state senate, and Congress. So it is a very ticket-splitting area. And right now, they're leaning very heavily towards Joe Biden. Biden's up in this district 55% to 38%. The race for the U.S. Senate is a little closer, but Peters is still up by 11 points, 50 to 39%. In that congressional race, again, going against some very tough atmospherics, Meyer is only down by 48%. Peter Meyer, who is the scion of the Meyer family, his father is Hank Meyer, who's worth the $7 billion, is running against Hillary Scolton, a former Obama appointee in the Department of Justice. Scolton is a very strong candidate and is leading here 48 to 41. But again, this is, again, running against some bad atmospherics in this district. Meyer's doing very well. In the state house race, Jim Hodsma leads Dave Morgan, again, 52% to 39%. So this is a very strong Democratic lead. No doubt that Hodsma is going to win this one.
So, yeah, we wanted to see, again, this is an area of the state where Donald Trump has spent some time. I believe he did his Christmas bash down in this part of the state late last year, John. And it just doesn't look like he's catching on. To see Hodsma up by 13 points right now would seem to, again, go back to what I said earlier, is that they are looking more up north as far as trying to take out an incumbent with Brian Elder, because as you go south, it certainly isn't looking very good for him here.
And that's why I say that whole I-75 corridor that we talked about. Go ahead, John. I'm sorry.
It's looking more and more like when you look at the suburban areas of this state, some of which Trump eked out that 2-point lead in 4 years ago. It's just not there for him. So it's going to be interesting. It's going to be all Northern Michigan UP for him, I think.
And that kind of leads us into our last race that we did, the 104th District, where there actually is some good news for Republicans and Donald Trump.
And again, that's that we talked about, that fact that he does very well in the rural districts in Northern Michigan, the UP, as well as in the Monroes, the McCombs, the Muskegons, and this is the case here. But his lead's not very strong for Northern Michigan. This is a seat held by Larry Inman, who they attempted to remove from office as a result of some issues related to campaign finance laws. But Trump leads Biden 48% to 44%. John James up on Gary Peters, 47% to 45%. And in the state House race, John Roth is up over Dan O'Neill, 48% to 40%. I was surprised at this one. I had heard this was a little closer race than an 8-point race at this point. I think the Republicans have been spending a lot of money in this seat, as they have been in some of the other seats. And so I think that's the reason that you see Roth up by the margin that he's up. So,
and I think it also speaks to how strong the Republican base is in rural parts of the state and also in northern Michigan, that we know that Traverse City itself is pretty moderate, can be a liberal in places. But once you get outside of the city of Traverse City, it is very strong Republican. And clearly, by looking at these numbers, Steve, they're extremely motivated and has got to. This has to give House Republicans a little bit of comfort to know that they're in one of these competitive seats that the Democrats is targeting. They're actually up pretty by a nice margin.
Yes, I would think so. Part of the problem they had in that seat was the candidate, Larry Inman. Inman, on a good day, is not a great candidate, and he had a lot of bad days, and that that occurred throughout his service in the House, and obviously the problems that he had. This should be a strong Republican seat. Again, here you've got an environment that's very friendly, with Trump leading, with John James leading in this area. This is a real advantage to Roth, and as I say, the House Republican Campaign Committee spending a lot of money in the seat right now.
So with this in mind, kind of give us your thoughts on what's going to happen here with the House races when it's all said and done. Right now, as you mentioned, the Republicans have control of the House by 58-51 margin, although the one seat there is a Democratic seat in Detroit. So it's really 58-52. But with that in mind, what do you foresee happening here?
At the end of the day, I think the Republicans will retain control. They could even lose a couple of more seats. I think that they think that they've got a real opportunity in that Elder seat. I think that they see some other win opportunities, even though they may lose some. I think they've got to really concentrate on the 45th. That's a seat that they should win. Republicans also have trouble in the 38th seat, where retiring Kathy Crawford is leaving that seat. They've got some real problem areas, but they also have some opportunities. The Democrats obviously see a real opportunity. If Biden can continue to do well in this state, that's going to benefit them. One of the problems we have is that it's still only early mid-September and late September, but we're in a position where the race can change dramatically. Now, early voting is going to happen starting on the 23rd, starting around most of the state, coming up very soon this week. So it's just too early to determine what's going to happen. Whoever would have dreamed when everybody was talking about the campaign on Friday that, Ruth Bader Ginsburg dies, igniting what will make the Kavanaugh hearing look like it was a kumbaya moment in American history. I mean, this is going to be a bloodbath, and it is going to impact the election. It's too early to say how. So, just too early. I mean, there's going to be so many, the long and winding road to election. It's a short time, but it's an enormously long time in politics. Mm-hmm.
John, if we'd had some more money, and you know you can never do enough polling because I know we would have liked to do some more, but given that the Republicans are now spending a lot of money in that Elder seat, it would have been interesting to see how he's doing up there in the 96th. And I'd also like to see what was going on in Berrien County with Chalkway Pitchford, just to see if the Democrats had any opportunity there at all, or maybe even the 43rd district in Waterford. That's the Andrea Schroeder seat, just to see how far the Democrats' reach went in Oakland County. But, you know, we only got so much. So,
we can only do so much.
Yeah,
I'm sure Steve would do another one for us if we wanted to come up with the money. But
well, it was this is a lot of polls to do at once, and so I burned the midnight oil over the weekend preparing for all this and getting it done and getting it over to you guys. So, but we always appreciate the business.
Thank you,
Steve.
Thanks very much, everybody.
Join us now on the podcast is the Chief Justice of the State of Michigan, Bridget McCormick. Thanks for joining us again on our podcast.
It's great to be here.
I'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I happened to notice on your Facebook page that you had an opportunity to meet the justice and wanted to find out what that was about and what it was like to meet her.
It was a pretty tremendous opportunity. She was visiting the University of Michigan Law School for a few days. The law school has had a number of the justices over the time I've been affiliated with it, and they had Justice Ginsburg in for a couple days, and she did some talks, both university-wide and just for law faculty and students, and I was lucky enough to be at a small lunch, and they seated me with her. And it was pretty wonderful to get to have an opportunity to talk to her in a personal way over a meal. I'm certainly glad I had that chance.
How long ago was this?
It must have been at least 4 years ago, could have been five.
Okay.
So it was, you know, shortly after I was first elected to the court, 2 or 3 years after.
Is there anything that particularly struck you about her?
You know, she was so... teeny. I don't know. If you look at that, honestly, there's a lot obviously better to say about her than that, but if you see the picture on my Facebook page?
Yeah, I did. You towered over her.
I look like the Jolly Green Giant. I mean, sheesh, you know, I'm not like enormous, but I certainly look it. But for someone as, you know, in a way strong as she is, man, was she... Does she appear in a teeny package and quiet too? She did a number of interviews at the law school and like I said, university wide, and she never raises her voice. You know, she never raised her voice. I guess I have to talk about her in the past tense now, don't I? But just a quiet, thoughtful answer to each question that almost gives it more power, right? Just by its quietness.
Right. What were your thoughts when you saw that she passed on Friday?
That 2020 is apparently not going to relent, is it? It's just going to be one thing after another here. I mean, it's sad, right? It's sad for the country. She's such a... I mean, sad when anybody passes, sad for her family, sad for so many young girls and women who... her story was such an inspiration for so many of them. I have to tell you, I didn't watch that documentary myself until... about 9 months ago, and I was visiting my sister, who has three girls, and her youngest, who was then in second grade, made me watch it.
Really?
Yeah, this little second grader. And my sister said, oh yeah, we've had to watch it about 42 times, so it's your turn.
Right.
It's your turn, man. Go for it, you know?
Right.
But to the story of, you know, how she persevered at a time when, you know, she graduates from, you know, as a top student from a top law school and can't get a job.
Right.
And then, you know, becomes this unbelievably successful advocate in the court she ends up sitting on. It's a great American story, isn't it?
It is.
It's a great American story. Yeah.
Any other thoughts that you have that you want to share?
I have two, and one is, and I think this is part of why her passing is sort of sad, her commitment to civility is something we don't want to let go of, right? I want to hold on to it with both hands. I mean, her friendship with Justice Scalia is famous. Everybody knows about that. It was genuine. It was deep. But I don't know if you've watched oral arguments that people say that when the justices leave the bench, Justice Thomas almost always helped her down by the hand.
Okay.
I, you know, she was just a decent person, deeply committed to, you know, civility, and even when disagreeing, doing it agreeably. And I don't know, we all need more of that, don't we?
Yeah. I was struck by looking at some of the comments that people put on your website. One of them is said, "Bridget, you are her legacy." What did you think of that?
That's crazy, and thank you, whoever said that, but absolutely not. I'm like a middle-aged Michigan mom trying to do the best I can for the people of the state of Michigan. That's fine by me.
So humble. All right,
no,
great.
Just realistic.
So you are running for re-election again this year, obviously, and this is your first re-election bid. You first ran for office in 2012, was victorious there. What do you think has changed from 2012 to 2020? What are you seeing? What are you hearing from attorneys and others who are interested in the court about how things have changed here in Michigan?
Everything's changed in the last 6 months, at least in the courts. Michigan courts this week surpassed 1 million hours of Zoom hearings since April 1st. We have seen more change in the courts in the last 6 months than in the last three decades, like far and away. It's, I've said a million times, it wasn't necessarily the disruption we wanted, but it might have been the disruption we needed to really figure out how we can transform what we do, make it more transparent, more accessible, more efficient. It's a really exciting time to be working in the judicial system.
And how much resistance did you get to these changes, to doing more of these video conferences over Zoom and over the internet?
You know, we didn't get any resistance once it was court's only option. I will say that we, at the Michigan Supreme Court, where we have administrative oversight of the courts of the state, and we have a talented administrative staff here at SCAO, we had actually purchased Zoom licenses for all of the judges in the state long before we had a pandemic, not because we were prescient. I wish I could take credit for that. I cannot. We just thought it probably made sense to figure out what business we do in courts that should be done on a remote platform, given how large Michigan is. You know, if you have a lawyer who needs to appear in Detroit at 9:30 and Grand Rapids at 10:30, that's usually not doable unless you're working on a remote platform. And now it's completely doable. Now lawyers are doing it all the time. But I will say, when we first got those licenses, every judge in the state had a Zoom license, and they had the hardware, the equipment in their courtrooms to be able to do this. But there were very few takers. It wasn't, I think most judges were sort of like, thanks for that, not sure what to do with that piece of technology. But all of a sudden, at the end of March, everybody had to figure it out. I mean, there were definitely some who were hoping this would pass kind of quickly and they wouldn't have to go learn a whole bunch of new skills and figure out new ways of doing things. But it set in that, in fact, this whole thing might be around for a while, and we were going to have to figure out how to make sure that the courtrooms are open, and open in a way that protects public health. Courtrooms, as you know, are really dense places that mix a lot of people together. And unlike restaurants and amusement parks, you don't have a choice about whether to go there. If a judge says you have to come to court, you have to go to court. You can't say, I'm going to eat at home tonight. Not an option. So we had to figure it out. And to their great credit, the trial judges throughout the state really stepped up. Michigan is literally leading the nation in how much we're doing on remote platforms. And it's because of the trial judges. They're the ones for whom this is a lot of work and very hard. For us at the appellate court, it's fairly easy. For them, it's a lot of work and it's very hard.
Was there a major issue or challenge you had to overcome as you sort of, the courts did this deep dive all of a sudden into this technology?
I don't know if there was a major issue to overcome. There were about 1,000 minor issues, just figuring out how to make sure the public still had access. Our tool of choice has been to live stream to the YouTube platform, but figuring that piece out at the beginning was interesting. The fact that courts need clerks who are independently elected and their county commissions who fund them to kind of all buy into significant changes was something we had to tend to right away. So we stood up a kind of rapid response task force with the county clerks and the county commissions to put together some quick resources, best practices, and information for judges and their staff with the buy-in from those other important partners. And then we had to figure out how to make sure the public understood what was happening, right? Especially in the district courts where so many people are self-represented. How do you communicate to them that they still can have their day in court? It's just going to look a little different and they're going to have to figure out how to log into this Zoom thing, which now everybody understands, right? We all do Zoom like, you know, all day long. But who did it before March 20th, right? Mm-hmm. Very few people. So there were some communication issues, some collaboration issues. I would say there were lots and lots of issues, but no single major one.
Well, the thing that I'm curious about is justice, as you're receiving justice through this video format, because I'm curious what kind of feedback you're getting from either plaintiffs or defendants or judges or whatnot on how they feel that's going, because it's a lot different to talk to somebody over a video screen like what we're doing right now and then to do it in person in a courtroom with the high ceilings and the ornate decorations. What kind of feedback are you getting on that?
So obviously the platform is not ideal for every single thing that happens in a courtroom. And there are reasons why the symbols in a courtroom and the majesty of it are important for administering a system of justice for some of the things that happen there. But as you probably know, a lot of the things that happen in courtrooms are fairly mundane and fairly routine. And, you know, there are scheduling conferences and status conferences and short appearances where none of that is necessarily critical to figuring out whether you're going to adjourn the case 3 weeks or 5 weeks, right? Mm-hmm. And at the same time, getting to court, parking, finding childcare, if that's your issue, can be really hard on a lot of people. For a lot of people, it's hard to figure out how to fit that in. I was on the phone with a judge in Kent County a couple of weeks ago, and he just got off the Zoom hearing where he took a misdemeanor plea from a young man who had gotten a job in Ohio about 4 hours away. And his job, it was a new job. And so he couldn't get a day off from work. And he was so thrilled that he could step into his break room, turn on his Zoom hearing on his phone, take responsibility for the charge that that he faced, understand what was going to be expected of him to be accountable, and just full of gratitude that he was able to keep his job and still make right with the court. And there are more stories like that, frankly, than stories of people feeling like, oh, I really miss the majesty. So people are really grateful for the accessibility and the efficiency it offers, for the most part. Obviously, not everything is translates perfectly.
I'm curious how you're finding running for re-election to the court now in COVID era compared to your prior experiences.
Yeah, it's definitely a different time to stand for election than the last time, or different than any other time. I guess maybe in 1918, people had to figure out how to run for election without putting people at risk. In some ways, I see the efficiencies that I see in running the courts. I mean, you can appear at a meeting in Marquette at 7 and Downriver at 7:30. The Zoom platform does allow statewide candidates like me to visit with people all around the state. Very little is happening in person, which is okay. I'm pretty busy with the day job nowadays, and so not finding a lot of free hours to drive around the state and visit in person anyway. So I think there are some efficiencies to doing it that way, and I guess we'll see. It's all like we're running the experiment, aren't we?
So last week here, you got the endorsement of the Michigan Chamber of Commerce, which I believe in my research is the first time they've endorsed a Democratic nominated justice in a long, long time. First of all, I wanted to get your reaction to that announcement, because for us that was pretty groundbreaking. Did you find it that significant?
Well, honestly, no, I did not. But thank you for the question. And I take your word for it about your research. I didn't know that because I haven't done that research myself. I asked for their endorsement and interviewed with them because I believe a lot of the work I'm doing is work that benefits everyone in Michigan, including their members. Their members need to make sure that the court systems can continue to operate and operate efficiently. And I'm working on that around the clock. At the same time, they now have 7 years of my work in the decision-making function to judge my commitment to the rule of law. And I feel confident that there's a lot to be proud of.
Now, obviously, in our system right now, you have to be nominated by a particular party, and you were nominated by the Democrats. Now, based on what we've seen here in the public, you are not necessarily the most partisan individual out there. Do you find that to be a level of frustration among Democrats, that you aren't as partisan as you are, and that maybe you don't utter the kinds of phrases like, we need to fight for this and we need to fight for that, that maybe you would see out of a regular Democratic supporter?
You know, I don't think so, although probably they wouldn't tell me to my face. So who knows? You might know better than I do. I take your word for it if they're frustrated with me. Maybe there are people frustrated with me, but I think that the court's nonpartisan nature is really, really important to public confidence in the court's work. And all we have, the only currency courts have, is public confidence. We don't have any weapons. We don't have any money. All we have is public confidence. And overwhelmingly, partisans on both sides of the aisle want independent courts. At least that's what they say when the National Center for State Courts polls them every year. They want an independent judiciary. I firmly believe they deserve an independent judiciary, and a good judge has to be willing to lose friends and lose elections. And I hope that's what they think they have in me.
What's your thoughts on the current makeup of the court? How do you feel like it's functioning? And I'm talking about the current justices, the mix that you have right now, compared to the one that you came into in 2012.
I love all of my courts equally, like all of my children. The court.
You are
right
a politician.
Now,
oh, wow. Listen to this.
but you're right that I've seen a lot of change since I arrived in 2012. You know, there have been justices who have come and gone since I got here. You know, Justice Larson has moved on to the Sixth Circuit. She arrived after me and then left before me. And Justice Wilder arrived after me and left before me. And Justice Young, who was here and is a very close friend, is now gone. And we've had lots of turnover. And but I will say it's been a high functioning court since I arrived here. I know it hasn't always been described that way historically. But it has been since I've got here. And that's not to say that it hasn't changed. It actually changes every time there's a new member. It's sort of, there's no way it can't. When you work on a multi-member court and you make every decision by committee, one person leaves and another one comes in, and the personality of the entire body changes some. But it's been high functioning, and I'm grateful to all of my colleagues. Obviously don't always agree with them all, but they always make me think more clearly, think more sharply when they do disagree with me, and I'm always grateful for it.
Is that the reason why the court has become far less, partisan come election time? I mean, Kyle and I talked about it recently. Used to be, it was a huge focal point to sort of win a seat to control the court. It seems to be less sort of intense, I guess, than it was several years ago.
Yeah, maybe so. I think when people are satisfied with the court's work, they're probably less likely to fight in partisan ways at election time. It does seem to me that in the last few cycles, we haven't seen the negative ads that you used to see, that used to be more common. In fact, the last time I ran, there were certainly negative ads in 2012. But I do think since then, I might not be remembering everything, and I don't always focus exactly, but I don't notice the negative ads like we used to see. And I hope that's a reflection of folks being satisfied with the court's work.
We haven't seen any sleeping judge ads, that's for sure. Maybe you haven't had any justices fall asleep on the bench.
Anyone can figure out how to make a sleeping judge ad if they want. You know, their video is apparently quite manipulable, I'm told. So if somebody wants to come for you with a negative ad, they can come for you with a negative ad.
The sleeping judge ad was a reference to Cliff Taylor. And then Brewer tried it on Bob Young, but that one didn't work because I don't think you could ever accuse Bob Young of sleeping on the bench. He's just a little too high octane for that.
Not sure he sleeps at night.
Last thing I wanted to ask you, are you going to be endorsing somebody else to join you on the court? Obviously, there's two slots.
I have only nice things to say about everybody running, even the ones I don't know. I would only say nice things. Elizabeth Welch is someone I've known for a long time. She's a tremendous lawyer. She's really a hard worker. She knows a lot about employment law, especially in the time of COVID. And I think she would add something to the court that would be a big asset. So I am supporting Elizabeth, but again, I am not interested in saying anything negative about anybody else. But I think she'd be a tremendous colleague.
Did you help recruit her?
I definitely talked to her about the opportunity for sure. I don't know how persuasive I was versus anybody else, but I did talk to her about the opportunity. I know her work and I like smart, hardworking people.
All right. Anything else you want to say?
I don't think so. Thank you again for the opportunity.
The Justice of the Supreme Court, Bridget McCormick, thank you so much for being on our podcast this week.
Thanks for having me.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to the Chief Justice of the Michigan Supreme Court, Bridget McCormick, Steve Mitchell for working with us on the poll numbers, GCSI. Also, thanks to the Insurance Alliance of Michigan for teaming up with us and GCSI on the polling results. The boss, John Rurank, AT&T, for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.